This episode is brought to you by Chiefs on Broadway. There's a different way to experience live music in Nashville. Eric Church's Chiefs on Broadway is home to the Neon Steeple, an intimate live music venue in the heart of downtown Nashville, where artists and songwriters take the stage for up-close, unforgettable shows. From stripped-down sets to surprise guests, no two nights are the same. Check out the Neon Steeple lineup and get your tickets now at chiefsonbroadway.com. It's June, and we believe there's no time quite like the summer to enjoy some country music. BGS is leaning into all things quality country with our sister site, Good Country. This month's edition of Good Country highlights Artist of the Month, Jody Messina, and we have sit-downs with Braxton Keith, the Broody Brothers, and Ashley McBride. Dive in at thebluegrasssituation.com/goodcountry. And welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the bluegrass situation. It's Cindy House. Hello. Hi. I host this podcast, and it is so nice to have you here. Okay, before we get into our guests today, Joe Henry and Mark Arelli, let's talk about ways to stay in touch with this little folk podcast. You can sign up for our newsletter at the link in the show notes or at basicfolk.com. It's a once-a-month newsletter that we send out that lets you know who's coming on the podcast, who's been on recently, and what we think about everything. That is the best way to stay in touch with us. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube. I don't know if we'll be on TikTok anymore, but we're on TikTok if you want to give us a follow there. You can also become a contributing member and help pay for the podcast, pay for your listening. Doesn't take a lot to make a difference and all that. You can make a contribution at the link in the show notes or go to basicfolk.com/donate. Happy March. Hope everything's going all right. This is like the worst part of the year, I think. Especially if you're living in the winter times, because you've just had it. I've had it. I am ready to not be in the winter anymore. But we're muddling through. Just get yourself the right gear and keep on keeping on. And make sure you go outside. That's very helpful. And maybe take a break from the news for a little while. Okay, let's get into the show today. Joe Henry has released 15 studio albums, apprenticed for legendary producer T-Bone Burnett, before he was T-Bone Burnett. And in turn, Joe has produced many other musicians' albums on his own, including 3 Grammy Award-winning albums for Solomon Burke, Carolina Chocolate Drops, and Ramblin' Jack Elliott. He's co-written a few songs as well, including a couple with his sister-in-law, who happens to be the one and only legendary pop icon, Madonna. His latest is Life and Time, a collaboration with songwriter Mike Reed, who has written many wonderful songs like I Can't Make You Love Me, one of Bonnie Raitt's most successful and beloved songs. In recent years, Joe has struck up a friendship with our bestie, Mark Arelli. Mark's been on Basic Folk 10,000 times, and in honor of his new record, Spring Green, we invited him to do whatever he wanted on this appearance for the pod. Mark chose to be in conversation with his friend Joe Henry on location in Joe's beautiful studio located north of Portland on the coast of Maine. In 2020, Mark was diagnosed with retinitis pigmentosa, or RP, which is causing him to slowly go blind. Joe was diagnosed with stage 4 prostate cancer in 2018 and was told he only had months to live. In 2026, his cancer is in remission and his health has improved. In our conversation, we tackle topics such as asking for help and finding hope while living with chronic illnesses. We also get into other parallels the two musicians have experienced, including how music has shaped their male friendships and being free of vanity. Mark and Joe have never worked together, but their respect and admiration for the other is clear in our time together. Here's hoping a collaboration is in the works for the near future. We'll take a listen to a song from Mark's new album, Spring Green, and then in the middle of the conversation, we'll play a couple of Joe Henry clips. But let's start listening to this song from Mark Arelli. This is Weary Traveler, and then we'll get to our conversation with Joe Henry and Mark Arelli on Basic Folk.
What smoke and a golden light from a cabin window on a winter night? Fire blazing in a hearth of stone to chase the chill from your tired bones. Weary traveler, elsewhere bound, lay down and take your rest. When the morning comes, you'll be on the run, off to someplace else. Come on in, out of the cold, sit right down, let me take your coat. There's room for another, the table is set, let's pour the wine, break the bread. Weary traveler, elsewhere bound, lay down and take your rest. When the morning comes, you'll be on the run, off to someplace else.
Joe Henry and Mark Arelli, welcome to Basic Folk with our special great guest, Francie, is in the background. Francie's going to babble during this interview, but we're just all going to deal
with it.
Takes
the pressure
off.
It's going to
be awesome. Yeah, it takes the pressure off. Okay, so thank you guys for doing this. This is so exciting. So first of all, we're in Maine. Can you each talk about your connection to Maine and how it's impacted your life and creativity?
Shall I go first?
You should.
Okay.
You've got a longer history.
Yeah, well, I went to college here. And basically, when I was trying to figure out where to go after growing up in suburban Boston, I felt like all the real songwriters were out in the real world, which, as far as I could tell, started in Texas and went west. But I was too scared to go from Reading, Massachusetts, right to Texas. So I came to Maine instead, which felt like the Texas of New England. And and it actually, the analogy holds in many ways. But I went to Bates College here, and then we actually came back a little bit when my wife was in graduate school and lived in Portland. So yeah, it kind of all, I started writing songs basically here in Maine. So it kind of started here.
Awesome.
I've only been here for a few years, or actually five as of December. I didn't have any connection to Maine other than I was intrigued by New England and was desirous of the weather. You know, we were 31 years in Los Angeles, and the thing that brings the most people to LA is the thing that made it ultimately untenable for a Celt like myself, who just, you know, hides from the sun. But I mean, we had a really rich life. Our deep community is still in Los Angeles. Both of my children are natives of Los Angeles. But some, I don't know, probably 25 years ago, my wife Melanie first started saying, who had never been to Maine, I don't know why, I just want to go to Maine. I just feel like I'm supposed
Did
to go to Maine.
Did she ever figure out why?
No, other than that she's kind of witchy that way, and here we are. So, you know, we knew we wanted to leave Los Angeles. It just was getting too hot and too crowded and too expensive for us to just hang on there. And there was a long period of time where most of my work happened in LA, most of my production work for sure. And then that was no longer the case. I was working in Nashville, I was working in New York, I was working in London, as much as I was working in LA. And I just said to Mel at some point, you know, we don't just have to be here. You know, I'm perfectly happy to come back here for work when it invites me to. I'm a person who doesn't mind being on a plane. I like to write in motion. But it was during COVID when we finally got it together to move. So we couldn't really explore a whole lot of options like we might have. It just felt dicey to do it. But our son, Levon, had a housemate in Brooklyn at one point that lives grew up on a farm in Topsom. And he and his partner at the time started coming to Topsom on holidays when they didn't have the time or resources to come back to California. And so when we started thinking about coming back east, looking in Connecticut and upstate New York, it was Levon who said, don't sleep on Maine.
Yeah.
You guys, go to Maine. We'll go with you. We'll check it out. And we came here with Levon and his partner at that time at the perfect October weekend. And I live for that.
That's how they get you.
Yeah.
That's what got me. I said, I don't need to see anything else. I can do this. And I imagined myself in a, you know, Civil War era townhouse in the old West End, but that's not where we are. We're coming to you from the wilds of Harpswell, which is what the universe had in mind for us. And we built a house, which we never
planned
on.
Yeah, we have to get
doing.
The name of your home builder, because this house.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
All right. How about your connection to each other? Like, what does that look like?
Wow.
Well, it started as a fan. I was just a fan.
I'm just going to say it's spiritual.
Yeah. Well, move from fandom to spiritual, I think, for me. I actually, it was a DJ from the local community that had a show on the Bates College radio station that turned me on to one of Joe's, earlier records. And so that was when you were first on my radar. And then I think I kind of maybe fell out of touch for a little bit of while with his music. And then I reconnected over his production of the Solomon Burke record, Don't Give Up on Me.
And so it started in the 90s and now we're in like 2002.
Yeah, we've been friends for, you know, more than since the last century, I guess.
Yeah, wow. It's the last century.
Yeah.
I mean, my memory is that we were likely ushered into each other's proximity by Rose Cousins, probably. She might be the first person that mentioned your name to me.
Interesting, yeah. Yeah, it was in Canada, I remember, at a festival.
At a festival, which is where I met her.
Yeah.
So I think it was that same weekend. I don't know if it was Calgary or Winnipeg or one of them. One of those
one of those great
gatherings where I just felt like I fell into the embrace of a number of people who are close to Rose. And she's become one of my closest friends in life. And so kind of anybody that is connected to her, I have an immediate kind of open attitude about.
Open door policy.
I do. Until they don't transgress, they're in.
Yeah. Right, right.
Phew.
I hear that you're both early risers and often early texters to each other. What is it about the morning that appeals to you?
Well, I mean, for me, it started happening to me before I was planning for it to happen. I was kind of in the midst of a new and fairly dire moment in my life, health-wise, and found myself waking up at 4:30, 5 in the morning, and realizing that if I got myself up and if I could slip out of our bedroom without waking up Melanie, and I could sit out in the front room and start writing anything, poem, song, whatever fragment it might be, that my entry point on the day was really, really different. My attitude about where I was in my life and what was possible was really different. And then I heard Toni Morrison say, well, you know, any serious writer is up before the sun. You know, and I thought, that's enough for me. I like to think of myself as a serious writer. And now I just find it a really kind of extraordinarily productive time, you know, where I used to believe that all the good shit happened late in the late night hours. It dovetailed into my recognition that when my kids were really young and I was getting up really early out of necessity and got them out of the door off to school, that it was in fact a really, really good time for me to be at work. And now when I get up, you know, 4:30, something like that, routinely, there's a number of hours that I get alone in the day before I'm using up what feels like real, this is not really even on the books yet. This is a whole bonus period of time. And I just have a real different perspective. And I just feel like I'm really free as a writer at that time of the day.
Oh, that's so fun to hear. Yeah. I mean, I guess I've always been a morning person. I used to get up. My grandfather lived with us when I was growing up. And I used to get up at like 5 and and go up to his little in-law apartment, and I used to watch the Adam West Batman reruns and wait for him to get up, and we would have cereal together. And then when I started to become a musician, I was really nervous about this morning person thing because, you know, most of your work happens at night, and I'd never been great at night. And so I had to really try to adjust, but it was very counter to my nature. And then I think it was during the pandemic, I'd like to say I was getting up early to write. Really, what was happening was I would get up around the same time, around 4:30, and I would just stress hard for like two or three hours till everyone else got up. And then I would tell myself, like, that's your stress for the day. Like, now you have to be like homeschooling dad, and you have to learn how to bake bread. You know, you got to do all this stuff, train the dog. And, but the, you know, it was kind of like dark night of the soul, but in the morning. And then, you know, anytime you're talking about the dark night of the soul, that involves social media. And eventually I would maybe post on social media early. And then of course you'd see the little thing and I'd be like, oh, Joe Henry just liked my tweet at 5 a.m. And it took a few months, but eventually I just like texted him one day, maybe around 6 a.m. I was like, you up? And he came right back. Yeah. And then it started.
Wow. Yeah. I used to host a morning show, and I am not a morning person. Yeah. And it is funny when you like see, this was back in the era where people would use GChat.
Yeah.
And I would see like, oh, who's online? GChat. Yeah. And like those people became your like best friends. Yeah. So Ireland, Mark has just returned from the first tour he's done in Ireland. And Joe, you have a strong connection to the country. And this might also be like a long meandering answer, but please, what are both of your histories with Ireland, experience playing music, and what have you found surprising about your time there?
Well, my history, I mean, I didn't ever make it to Ireland until 2011 or 12. I could find out very easy by Googling when Seamus Heaney died, because I happened to have been in Dublin the night before he passed. And I was in the company of his closest friend, the poet Peter Fallon. And so up until that point, my connection to Ireland was just like feeling spiritually, absolutely, from the time I was in my teens and would have discerned it. Like, you know, like my bell really was rung by a lot of Irish music and a lot of Irish literature. So it was just this existed as this wild specter, and I didn't even understand how have I been touring in Europe all these years and I've never gotten to Dublin. I mean, I guess that's what happens when you have a British booking agent. Just didn't take Ireland seriously. But I had produced a record for a woman who's become my really, really dear friend, Lisa Hannigan. And I thought when I got hired by Lisa, okay, I'm finally going to get to Ireland. But no, she wanted to record in Wales because she needed to get out of town, because she said, everybody will stop by and we need to go somewhere remote. So we went to North Wales to record, but it was, you know, on her coattails that finally brought me to Dublin for the first time. And I just got pulled into the embrace of her bandmates. I come out of a lot of production projects with deep friendships. I mean, it's never a guarantee, but more often than not in my life, I've emerged from what was just a brief 4 or 5 day recording project with friends that I know that I have for the rest of my life. And Lisa's certainly one of them. And I just got to, you know, my wife and I have an old dear friend from our New York days who's from Ireland, who somehow finagled me a writing residency at a small arts college on the west coast of Ireland in the fall of 2018. So I was, and I produced Rhiannon Giddens just serendipitously while I was there. So a lot of just kind of magical things have happened to me. Not all of them positive. I mean, some of them have been quite spooky, but it's not like Ireland isn't known for that too. I mean, it's a longer story than I would tell you, but I did find myself one night in, sort of terrified about my health journey in John Prine's bathtub. And I took tremendous comfort in the fact that I was in John Prine's bathtub.
Oh man, I wish I had anything to compare with that. But the first time I got to Ireland was 2019, summer 2019. I was playing in Josh Ritter's band, And Josh had been, you know, met with some acclaim in Ireland early on. And it was kind of mythical amongst us singer-songwriters in the Boston area. Like, oh yeah, Josh is a big star in Ireland. And I was like, really? You know, but then we went over there and we did two shows at the end of this English run at the National Concert Hall in Dublin. And the response after the first song both nights was just overwhelming. And I had two thoughts. I said, okay, one, yes, Josh is very well loved here in Ireland. And two, how do I get a little bit of this, you know? And it took me another 8 years. And I went over there with my buddy and friend of the podcast, Dinty Child, as a duo. And we had 10 shows over there and just had a lovely, lovely time.
So another thing that you were talking about with you and Dinty going over to Ireland was that you were very open about how much Dinty was helping you, Mark, with driving and, you know, booking things and just taking care of a lot of things due to your RP. Is it okay to say RP?
Sure. Yeah. Retinitis pigmentosa, RP just, for short.
Yeah, yeah. That's what RP means. So what has been both of your relationships with asking for help and how has that changed or evolved?
Mm-hmm. What a question.
Right. I could probably speak to this for you. Give you some time.
Yeah.
You know, my disability is an invisible disability. You wouldn't know it if I don't have my cane out or something like that. You can't tell that I can't really see in certain conditions. And so if I'm going to navigate a situation, you know, either like literally navigate around a country or, you know, metaphorically, I either have to just be all on my own and try to fumble through, or I have to be kind of brave enough to admit that there's some things that I can't do or that I need help with. And that was very hard for me at first. Like I kind of take a lot of pride in kind of dealing with my own shit, you know, like if it's something goes wrong, it's not going to be because I didn't take care of something that was within my control, you know? And now there's just a lot less within my control. And so for me, it's all been about like leveraging or kind of relying a little bit more on the good friends that I surround myself with, you know, both for not just for driving and navigation stuff, but also, you know, kind of like spiritual, emotional kind of support too. And you know, I would count Joe among that group, like people that I can reach out to if I'm feeling something that I don't know if I can carry on my own in that moment. And I don't have to explain, you know, there's not a lot of extra context that needs to happen and they get it. And Joe's one of those people that does that. So there is a bit of bravery that is required in asking for help. And I, though I hesitate to use that word because I don't feel brave when I finally screw up the courage to ask somebody, but it's been my experience that, you know, once you do, a new world opens up to you and, it's oftentimes a lot less frightening and challenging than you had envisioned it being.
Well, I realized that, you know, my answer to the question is that I have not learned well enough how to ask for the help I need. I also am fairly invisible with my illness. I mean, I have stage 4 prostate cancer, and I've had it for 7+ years. You know, I was originally told I had 3 to 7 months to live, but I'm aware that I'm a bit of an outlier. I've survived really differently than most anybody that I am aware of, as far as people I've met, people I've talked to, even my own doctors. The three that I've had have all used the word outlier at some point or another. People meet me, they don't know that I'm walking around with something that I'm told is going to end my life ultimately. I'm not so sure, but I do know that it's hard for me to ask for for help, because I'm sure that there's a psychological cascade of asking for help. It, you know, it's telling myself that I need help, which is telling myself some story that I'm, you know, losing some kind of ground that I possessed before. And I don't know at this moment that I don't need any extra help than I would normally need, other than the fact that I am now 65. I don't have limitations in my movement, in what my work life asks of me. That's not always going to be true, and I'm keenly aware of that. And learning to ask for help with really small things, by its nature, has to come before being able to ask people for help for the really big things down the road. And I'm keenly aware of it. I don't know how well I'm doing with it.
Mark also mentioned on the Ireland tour, Mark did a lot of great social media posts, by the way. Great fodder.
That was my contribution. I couldn't drive. So.
Right. So you mentioned the sense of friendship and brotherhood you felt with Dinty, the other musician that was on tour with you, Dinty Child. So how have each of you experienced male friendship thanks to music, and how has that changed your relationship to being a modern man?
Well, you know, my writing life has been, until the last few years, been incredibly solitary. My production life is very collaborative, and I've been really fortunate in a lot of my production life to have had really deep friendships with the largely, but by no means exclusively, male musicians with whom I work. I work with a lot of women as well, but I noticed things about a very particular group of male musicians that I grew to be close with in my years in Los Angeles. Very sensitive, caring, affectionate people. So once I realized that was kind of available to me, I just kind of stopped working with anybody that I didn't fit that description. You know, I steered wide of, you know, anytime somebody would say about so-and-so, you know, he's kind of an asshole, but he's an unbelievable guitar player. I said, I'm not interested. There's a million mind-blowing guitar players walking around. There just are. I don't want to work with anybody anymore who I don't want to have a meal with, who I wouldn't be happy to be sitting next to on a plane or a train or in a long car ride somewhere. I don't want to work with anybody I don't want my family to be around. And as soon as I understood that, a lot of difficulty in my working life disappeared.
Wow, I love that.
I guess I there's a lot of parallels there for me as well, though I think a lot of my deepest professional relationships, both at the start and even to this day, have been with female artists. You know, people like Chris Delmhorst and Lori McKenna. You know, Chris gave me my first sideman job, and I'm still sideman with Lori, you know. So I've spent a lot of time traveling with female artists, even just as like a duo. And that felt very comfortable, I think, because of that sensitivity, that dimension of sensitivity that Joe was talking about. And then just over time, I don't know if you attract it to yourself or you're better able to just recognize it in others, but you start to see the sensitive guys and you start collecting those relationships. Like, okay, that guy I can handle, you know, and he can handle me. And I dare say, I won't name names, but I think there's some guys in my life now that are very, very deep friends, among my closest friends, that maybe weren't so sensitive as they seem to me now. And I don't know if it's just a fact of them getting a little bit older and you know, a little further down their own path, or whether it's interacting with me. I don't know. You know, I don't want to take credit for that, but I've definitely noticed people evolving. And then as they get more sensitive, I'm like, okay, now is the time. Yeah. You know, because it's like Joe said, there's just so many great musicians and great artists that are just truly wonderful people that you don't really have to put up with any of the BS from the ones that, you know, don't want to treat people.
I mean, in my studio life, I think it's true that I think a lot less about instrumentation than I think about just characters I want to populate you know, the room. Almost any time an artist comes to me, I sometimes produce a band that exists as a band, but more often than not, part of what I'm expected to do is cast a room. And I think a lot about what individual personalities, you know, mean supportively through the course of a short, fairly intense project. Almost every record I make happens within 3 to 5 days. Pretty rare that I work on anything that goes longer than that. And I also recognize that it was a big reveal for me at the point when I became a parent, because I've had to say to a number of people that I was producing with in my early life, you know, somebody, I like you, I don't need to name a name, but, you know, somebody who just expected the fact that I was their producer meant that I was carving out all kinds of time to hang post-session. And there was just this expectation that when it didn't happen, management called me out on it. And I said, you know, my family's not my hobby. You know, I'm the first person in the studio when we, you know, when the day starts, I'm the last person who walks out. Your client's not entitled to more than that, you know, for me. And if they have a problem with it, they should talk to me. But I'm giving them all that I have. That does not mean everything that I am. And I just started to notice people who respected the fact that my family was a big part of decisions I made about the way that I operated when I recorded. I don't start sessions at 2 or 3 or 4 in the afternoon. You know, I get up at 4. My best hours are behind me if we're starting at, you know, 5 in the evening. Like, I've worked with some people who that's what they prefer. And that's been a tough wrangle for me. Mm-hmm. Finding people who respected the life that I was leading that allowed music to happen, not just, you know, the music work itself.
Guys, this is some good dirt that we're collecting here. Okay, fair warning, this question is half a page and it includes a Thomas Merton quote.
Oh, I love Thomas Merton. I'm ready for you.
Okay. So Mark's new record, Spring Green, Mark, you shared, I wanted to release myself from the impulse to showcase all the different musical things I'm capable of doing and focused instead on simply being. Awesome. Record sounds so good. Joe, you were on the podcast On Being, and you were discussing this Thomas Merton quote. If you write for God, you will reach many men and bring them joy. If you write for men, you may make some money, and you may give someone a little joy, and you may make a noise in the world for a little while. If you write for yourself, you can read what you yourself have written, and after 10 minutes, you will be so disgusted that you will wish that you were dead. So that's from Seeds of Contemplation from Thomas Merton. So you explained of that quote that the intention of writing for all mankind or writing for God is to free yourself of your own vanity and the idea of having everything have to reflect back on yourself. Here's the question. Who have you guys written for and made music for? How has that evolved? And what does it feel like to finally, it sounds like, Mark, you're right there with Joe on this one, finally free yourself of your own vanity?
Hmm. Oh, wow. That's a big one.
There's a lot of question in there.
That's an amazing quote.
It's so good.
Yeah, it is. And I read it when I was quite young. I mean, I read it in my teens. I mean, to finally get to the point when you are writing, you know, free of ego. And I mean the original, not the way that people normally mean ego when they say it in a conversation, but what it actually means, you know, that everything is revolving, you know, how does everything exist in relation to me? I'm considering everything based on how it is in relationship to me. I've just never thought like that as a writer. I never set out, I set out to deliberately not write songs rooted in autobiography. I was brushed back by people that I thought were doing that. I thought I haven't lived enough of a life to make that the basis for everything that I'm doing. I'm so much less interested in self-expression and so much more interested in discovery. And once I had that phrase for myself and understood that, I felt really liberated, you know, to do consciously what I had been doing sort of unconsciously for a long time. I knew that I wasn't writing about myself, even though after the fact I could see myself in things that I had written, but I knew that's not what I was consciously reaching for at the time I was, you know, in process. So, you know, who am I writing for? You know, I'm writing for kind of an imagined, you know, community, of which my job is to try to be a connector where I can. Just like, you know, somebody's job is to fix my shoes, and my job is to be some kind of custodian to community. And the way that I think almost every creative endeavor is hardwired to be, whether we're aware of it or not.
In contrast to kind of what Joe was saying there about the artists that you were gravitating towards, you know, like, I think I actually gravitated towards some of those, I don't know if you'd call them, I hate this word, confessional songwriters, yeah. But, you know, people have thrown that tag around to, you know, Joni Mitchell and Jackson Browne, mm-hmm. you know, and Jackson Browne's kind of like the big one for me. And I definitely felt deeply emotionally connected to a lot of what I heard in his songs. And of course, I didn't know him. I still don't. Mm-hmm. And I was like, how do you do that? How do you write about yourself and then have other people understand and connect with it? And I think for me, it's been a process of trying to write for the man that I want to be and in the voice of the man that I want to be. So I would hazard a guess that maybe those familiar with my work might think, oh, he's an optimistic, you know, hopeful guy. And I am in my strongest moments, but, you know, I'm also not, because I'm human and I have a range of emotions. But I tend not to write from anger or sarcasm or bitterness, just because they don't feel like sustainable emotions. You know, they feel like they burn out pretty quickly. And it also feels pretty easy to hit those targets. Like I know when I've, you know, nailed bitterness or sarcasm, you know, right in the bullseye. But, you know, hopefulness or out of like a deep sense of love and compassion and empathy, like those just feel infinite. And so it's been my goal to try and get closer to what it feels like to embody those, even though I know that I'll never get there. And so I guess if I'm writing for anyone, which I don't often have the sense that I'm writing specifically for someone, but stepping back a bit, it feels like, I guess, like I'm writing for that something, for that guy that I want to be to sing. And then, of course, you know, you have to go all over the world to Ireland or wherever, and you got to sing that guy's words believably. And it's, you know, you're not acting. I mean, there's a bit of theater in it, but you're also deeply invested in that guy's emotions and his words. And you start to be that person a little bit more every time. And so I don't know, I guess I feel like the process of songwriting in that way makes me slightly better over time. That's the hope. But really going back to that Merton quote, you know, that writing for God, like that mystery for me at the core of everything, that's the thing that you have to find a way to kind of abide with and be able to kind of cozy up to and not be, you know, terrified of the void of not knowing what's in that mystery, because even if you chip away at the edges, you can't ever get to the center of it. That to me is what God is. So, you know, also my attempts to investigate that have really kind of brought me closer to that guy that I want to be, as opposed to like the Catholic full of shame that I was, you know, raised up in.
Well, I always write in first person, or almost always. I just think that's the most intimate place from which to speak. It's the most seductive place from which to speak. But it's confusing to people because, you know, the singer-songwriter so-called confessional era that you're referencing, I was coming of age during that period of time. And Jackson Browne, who has been a friend for, you know, 30-some years now, I didn't gravitate toward him when I was, you know, a teenager, when a lot of my friends, especially my close friends who were women in high school, you know, heard a lot in his story and the way that he spoke in song that connected deeply with him that did not for me. The light kind of went on for me with him later, even though I was aware that what's working about what he's doing, I don't know how to do that. You know, I don't, you know, even though I'm speaking and it's confounding to people sometimes that if you say I and then you tell them later that I don't mean me myself. I'm in a character. But I noticed that when I, you know, even when I see myself in things that I'm writing, the I that speaks in the songs has a lot, you know, much more courageous than I am as an actual person. Their spirituality lives in more extremes, you know, than I see myself, both in elation and devastation, you know, as far as a relationship to, you know, any sense of a creator. I noticed a lot of things about that consistent voice that I know where it converges with who I recognize myself to be, and I know where it really divides and peels away from, you know, the person that I think that I am. I like that person. I like that person's vulnerability, that character's vulnerability, and their willingness to give it up. I know that that's only part of, you know, who I am.
Yeah, that answer, you know, we had to give you an answer commensurate with the length of the question.
Yes, of course. It's interesting to think you only sing in the perspective of I, and it made me wonder, does Randy Newman sing in the perspective of I? Because he has.
Yes.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
And he happened to me when I was 13, and nobody, with the exception of a possible exception of Bob Dylan, had a bigger impact on the songwriter that I became than he did. And for that exact reason, I heard him at 13. I bought Good Old Boys. It was a brand new record when I bought it. And I don't know how I understood completely instinctively that he was not, you know, like as Rimbaud said, you know, I is another. I knew that the I that he was representing was not Randy Newman, the songwriter. I knew that he wasn't from Alabama. I knew that he wasn't married to a woman named Marie. I just assumed that he was a storyteller, like a lot of the, you know, songs, kind of narrative country songs I heard as a boy in the South. You know, it connected to, you know, a lot of that tradition, but he was also deeply invested in the American songbook and theater and film music. I loved film even as a young boy. So he was an enormous, remains an enormous character for me.
I wanted to ask you a question about grief and acceptance. So both of you, we talked about, are living with chronic conditions, Mark with RP, Joe with stage 4 prostate cancer. It seems like you've both been on this journey of grief to acceptance and maybe even hope. Pulled that right from your album bio, Mark. What does that look like for each of you?
You know, I'll just say right off the bat that the person, aside from my family and my wife, the person that helped me make sense of a lot of that is doing this podcast with me today.
And it's not me.
Yeah. when I asked Joe if he would write, you know, if he would write the liner notes essay for Lay Your Darkness Down, which was my previous studio record where I kind of was dealing with my diagnosis kind of head on. The thing that you wrote, I almost couldn't believe that was about me and my work. I thought, like, I think, did he get the wrong file or something that I said? Like, can this really be the mission that I was engaged in? And can this really be what I have accomplished with this music? And I realized right then, one of the things that you wrote was like, one of the greatest gifts And one of the things we most want and one of the greatest gifts we can give another person is the gift of them feeling seen. And, you know, at a time when you were literally told you were losing that, that sense of sight, you know, the stuff that goes through your head among many things is, if I can't see, not only will I not be able to see others, but like, will I be able to see myself? And, you know, Joe's essay showed me that, you know, that yes, you can see yourself in the work, and other people can see you in the work as well. And, yeah, it was just, it took the edge off of the grief for me, you know, and there were a lot of other things that I was engaged in at the time to try and pull out of that nosedive. Yeah. Just the kindness, that was invested in the heart that was invested in that essay. I've thanked you many times for that, but I'll do it again.
You are so welcome. And I'm touched that you would share that. I mean, for me, grief has been really a moving target. I don't feel like I've got a good handle on it. You know, some days better than others, but I'm a person who did not grow up in grief. My wife is a person who grew up in grief. You know, she lost her mom when she was 18 months old, grew up in a house of kind of rampant addiction and all manner of emotional and physical violence. And I did not. I grew up, I was raised by the most loving, supportive parents, even when they didn't understand how I was going to do what I said I was set on doing. They didn't know how to do anything but support me and encourage it. That was just the luck of that draw that I grew up like that. Not to say I didn't have some trauma in my upbringing. We moved a lot when I was young. That was deeply traumatic for me. You know, we moved from the South to the Midwest right when I was starting fourth grade, for example. And I was really a target to be bullied. I was very small. I was really sensitive. I had a Southern accent. I had a stutter. Things that just made me a real target. So I kind of retreated into music. That was kind of just where I, you know, where I went. That's just the well that I ran to. But the fact that I grew up as loved and supported as I knew myself to be, I think I was really blindsided by the grief that followed my cancer diagnosis, and partly because I didn't know that that's what it was. I didn't know that this was like an anticipatory, I mean, not just an anticipation of greater grief later, but the grief of just, okay, now I got to wear this around. How do you keep living life and living robustly and having to wear this, you know, first thought in the morning, last thought at night, what you assume everybody thinks about you when they talk about you, if they talk about you at all. I didn't know what to do with any of that. You know, I'm still trying to figure that out. And some days I'm much more evolved in that direction than other days. And our access to hope is intrinsically connected to our ability to love ourselves through whatever our grief might be. You know, forgive ourselves, what does Maya Angelou say? Forgive ourselves for what we didn't know before we knew it. That I find that the more I'm able to sort of make real deliberate peace with my grief, not as a way to try to usher it out of the room. It lives here. It knows how. But when I'm the most able to just feel like, you know, my goal is to live into the experience of this life, whatever it is, I automatically feel more hopeful by making that connection. I wouldn't have known that if I hadn't felt it as a fact of my existence.
Yeah, I mean, God, that's so beautiful, so beautiful. And it brings to mind this other dimension of grief that I've experienced, that I think some of what you were saying there is like, grief is a teacher in a way. And, when I got my diagnosis, I both myself and my wife started grieving intensely for all the things that we thought were going to happen and that may not be able to happen anymore. And like we were grieving the way that our lives were supposed to work out. And then, you know, the grief teaches you that like actually none of that was ever a given anyway. Yeah. And nobody knows how their life is going to work out, especially if you're making, you know, stringent plans. You know, the universe kind of laughs at that. And so, the grief, in addition to kind of being this like overwhelming sadness, was also on the flip side of that, was also like, oh, it's kind of showing you the way life as it actually is, which is like, it is, there's that mystery again. Like you don't know how it's going to turn out. And your task is, how do you live with that? How do you abide that mystery? And how do you, you know, in the long term and in the day to day, how do you get out of bed at 4 a.m?
Absolutely. I mean, I like you say, our lives have always been unwritten. I just feel like mine is sort of newly unwritten. I'm confronted daily with the fact that I don't know, and I really don't know. And I have to remind myself that, you know, who else doesn't know? My doctor doesn't know. And sometimes my doctor is tempted to point to a fixed place on the horizon that he predicts, you know, this is the point where you're going to sail off this flat earth. And I had to tell him, you know, if you're going to remain my doctor, you can't do that anymore. My spirit matters to my healing, and you deciding, you know, talking to me as if you know how my story ends. I remember when he said that to me last time, he tried to have that conversation with me. I said, look, you know, I'm getting on an airplane tomorrow. I've seen the Buddy Holly story. There's all kinds of ways this can go.
Yeah.
You're not telling me not to buckle up on my drive home because you know how my story goes. You don't know. And he said, you're absolutely right. We don't know. There's so, you know, we think we know a lot, and we do, but there's so much more that we just absolutely do not know. So it's a constant effort for me to remind myself that I'm not living into anybody else's idea about how my life plays out. And thus far, there's not one advantage to me adopting anybody else's idea about how my life plays out.
Wow.
There's all kind of shit that happens.
Yeah.
I mean, I know people, telling you that I can think of a few people off the top of my head who attended me when I first got diagnosed and felt bad for me. And I knew what were talking about me quietly in the next room who are no longer here. Oh, they did not imagine that I, in any way, shape, or form, was going to outlive them.
Wow. That's amazing.
There goes the sun descending, its light in the street defending what all of our day is upending. Of all the eye can see, trouble begins at waking, the weight of the world near breaking, its wave on the heart's undertaking, of all the eye can see, what's between us has barely seen us. We're just the river to its sea, falling mountains all around us. Still you keep your peace with me. Here comes the night unfurling, its torn holy flag still burning, at borders that bleed until blurring,
all the eye can see.
Mark and I talked on the phone yesterday. We were talking about you. He was recounting a conversation that he had with you, Joe, about quote unquote failed records and how Mark had always used like a certain yardstick as a measure of success. Like, does it register? And I'm putting words in your mouth here, Mark, so correct me if I'm wrong. Like, does it register with critics, with audiences? Does it, did I make $1 million? Did I get, you know, a lot of rewards? But Joe, your version of a quote unquote failed record was when you couldn't quite capture the sound on tape that was actually in your mind. So in thinking about that, what was the process of forming your artistry? Like, was it a gradual evolution? Were there any aha moments that sparked this large leap ahead of how you were able to define your sound?
Interesting question. I mean, a lot of it was just sort of kind of retroactive affirmation when I found out that a lot of the records that I most responded to and continued to respond to, you know, there are mistakes, every so-called mistakes everywhere, bleed in all the mics. You know, it's a balance of a smear of sound. It's not about everything being isolated and then so, an engineer at a control board using, you know, delays and reverbs to recreate this sense of you know, atmospheric crosstalk that's perfectly available to anybody who's standing in the middle of the room when it's happening, when music's being played in real time by people together. And I just started understanding that those records that I kept going back to that had so much blood in their veins, they were almost all made with people live in a room, kind of hanging on in moments of discovery together. And that the records that were built piece by piece and everything is controlled and separate and reassembled later felt lifeless to me. I wasn't excited, you know, as a teenager in real time. You know, I had friends who listened to, you know, Fleetwood Mac and Steely Dan and things like that. Didn't interest me. It did not do anything for me at all, you know. And I would go home and put on a Lead Belly record and I'd say, they're not even close. You know, they're not even close to what this is doing to me. Edith Piaf, Frank Sinatra, Robert Johnson, you know, Django Reinhardt. I go on forever. These records where you just can't miss that there is a moment when the song stands up and identifies itself and that there's not a single person in the room that's uniquely and totally responsible for it. It's like a seance. If everybody's weren't around a table, joined in hand with a shared intention, this could not happen. And so once I understood that those records were made the way I imagined they could only be made, which is, you know, if you want it to sound like people are having a moment together, you better get them together.
It's funny, like failure is such a, it's such a strong, strong word. I mean,
so judgmental.
Yeah.
It must be German.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I always loved the records that I was making, and yet I knew what they were bringing in. You know, I knew that like I'd make a record and then I would not have enough money from the sales of that record to make another record, let alone, you know, just life stuff. And to me, that along with all the other, you know, kind of successful, like I had friends that had real success that I was very close to and still am, and I'm very happy for it. But I was like, okay, so it's possible. Like, it happens to people. It happened to them. They were standing right here, you know, like, why isn't it happening to me, you know? And that became a question that lived alongside the art for a long time. It wasn't that I ever altered the art to try and attract that lightning bolt, you know, like to strike a few inches to the left. I have said stubbornly for years, like, I don't want to change what I do in order to be successful. I just want people to recognize what I do and enjoy some degree of success that allows me to keep doing it, you know? But you do this long enough and you start to realize how unhelpful outside barometers and yardsticks are and how little control you have over so much, and why cede that last bit of agency over what feels like a win. And so, you know, over time, I've gotten a little bit better at kind of putting all that stuff in perspective. I think it was Chuck Prophet, who I interviewed for this very podcast. Actually, I read his a biography of his, and there was a quote in there that I'm loosely paraphrasing that he said, as far as the lies we tell ourselves, quote, this next record is going to change my life is not that, you know, it's not that bad a lie to tell yourself. And I still kind of tell myself that every time I make a record, but now I'm old enough and experienced enough to kind of realize that it is true. Every record does change you. It doesn't necessarily pay for the next one, but you are a different person. And I do feel like a different person when every record, you know, I get under my belt, and you know, whatever comes from that is what's supposed to come from it.
It's really interesting that you framed it that way, because I felt like there was a real moment of liberation for me when I kind of made a decision to stop thinking about every record I made as if it was a lottery ticket. You know, like, maybe this is the one. Mm-hmm. You know, this is the one who's finally going to, you know, vindicate me. And at a certain point, I just decided, you know, I want my records to do well. I want to be heard. I want to play nice theaters, you know, where people arrive with a certain kind of expectation because they brought themselves to this kind of a place, and it's framed in a certain way. It's presented in a certain way. I can afford to have the musicians play with me that I think are essential for me to do what I mean to do. But once I kind of liberated myself from this idea that this next record, you know, that what it meant out in the world to anybody else would leak into the actual making of the record. I realized that was a disastrous border not to be defending, that I make records because I'm hotwired to do it. I produce records, you know, to make a living. And because I love making records, I like the art form of making a record, whether it's my voice in my song or somebody else's. But I make my own records because I want to and I need to. And it sort of advertises my persona somehow as a producer, though I don't know how. I don't sell enough of them to justify the fact that I've continued to work as a producer. I've had to say to most people I'm going to work with, you know, before we go into this, that I don't sell any records, right? I mean, that's just not how it works for me. And you need to understand that doesn't drive me. Once the record is done, I have a lot of hope for it, and I want it to do well as it can do. But I can't remember ever once, literally, ever once making a decision in the studio for myself or anybody else based on whether I thought it would make people like me better.
You know, something that T-Bone Burnett said about you is that he learned to look for the most powerful takes, not the most pristine. Hmm. So what would make a take powerful to you?
That I was desperate to hear it again. You know, it wasn't just something that we listened to and started talking about and got as involved in talking about it as we, you know, as we would be in actively, you know, playing it again or listening back. And as a producer, I almost never play on anything that I'm working on because I think my job is to be completely hands-free, so that when a song happens in real time in the room, I stand there as a proxy for whatever audience this music might ever have. It's like somebody has to stand here as a litmus to whether or not this experience was moving when it happened. And when I listen to it and I just like, you know, God, we gotta, you know, let's hear that again. And I know that something is something about it's changed the, you know, the course of my blood and my body. There's just a vibration.
Desperate is a really good, yeah. Desperation is such a good word. Yeah.
That's, I think we're talking about the same thing here, but I'm maybe going to use slightly different language. And I just had this experience making Spring Green. The first day we were in the studio, you know, you're usually taking a little bit longer to set up. You're getting your sounds, you know, and oftentimes that first day is not super productive in terms of like the number of songs you get because you just had to spend all that time setting up. The first day of the 3 days that we did making Spring Green, we got 5 songs that first day. And the way that that happened was I knew that we had it when I didn't want to hear it again. If we're talking about the same thing, but using, I think, just the inverse language. I just knew. I was like, well, that was it. I know that was it for me. And if anyone else screwed up, well, we'll deal with them later. Yeah. But I know that that was the one, and I don't need to hear it again. And actually the second day when we came back, my buddy Zach Hickman, and who, you know, generously let me in as a co-producer on this one. We kind of had a sidebar when we got to his house. He said, let's just listen to a few of these things just once, just to make sure that we got it. And we did, you know, go back and listen before the band came in. And I was like, I told you, it's there. This is it. We got it. You know, we don't have to. It's not that we never listen to anything, but it's just like, I know that that's the take when I don't feel compelled to hear it again. When I do wonder if we got it, then I think like, well, let's just do another one. You know, if I have to wonder.
I think it's easier to feel certain, easier for me when it's not my record and not my voice. I can need to be reassured that what I felt happened actually happened, and that everybody else was, you know, at least in proximity to what they meant to say. Because I have so much respect for the people that I most typically play with, or anybody who I would be recording with. But when I'm producing somebody else, and I'm just totally standing there as a listener, there's always a moment when I just like, that just sounded like a record, and it might you know, be a mess in some ways. It might need to be repaired in a number of ways, but that doesn't. You know, I can hear right through that. It's not a distraction to me if emotionally, you know, what happened, what needed to happen, happened. I've spent a lot of my production life trying to convince artists not to fix shit just because it wasn't, you know, just because that's not what you meant to do doesn't mean that it wasn't effective and powerful. And before we just, I mean, if we listen to it and it's a distraction, of course we'll address it. We can address anything. I'm not opposed. I'm not a purist by any stretch. I will, you know, chop, channel, edit, fly shit around. That's anything that, I mean, it's all theater, you know, this idea that anybody's doing it for purity. I think it's bullshit. I mean, as soon as it's coming out of a pair of speakers, it's already something that's been sampled. You know, Alan Lomax was sampling Lead Belly. You know, we listened to an electronic representation of a frequency that puts Lead Belly in mind. That, you know, that's not him. You know this idea that this song just stood up like a living thing and told us who it was and where it lived, and we might have thought 2 takes ago that it was a really, really different character, but it has enough character now that it's telling us what it needs and what it, you know, how we serve it. And when people, you know, artists do something they didn't intend to do, like I remember having a really hard moment. I was Ani DeFranco's first producer that she had that wasn't herself. And there was a moment when we kind of got into it about her picking what I thought was a significantly inferior take to the one that had come before it that I thought I knew was just, that was the take. But her voice had broken in a very particular moment, and she was determined that it was a live record on the floor and that it was either a take or it wasn't a take. And I said, look, before you throw that out, you know, listen to what's happening. I mean, this is my memory of the event. You know, she may remember this really differently. I mean, she's a deep artist and a deep thinker. But I can remember this conversation of saying, you know, that break in your voice there that felt like a mistake to you just jarred me out of complacency as a listener. And a lot of things that happened that the musician who executed the moment thinks of as a mistake just reminds people, like, you know, my analogy of you go to the circus and you see somebody on a high wire. If they just walk straight across, you go, what's that?
No big deal.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. But as soon as they wobble, you're reminded that there's a human being up there with their ass hanging out, risking something. And I think those moments on any recording where we're reminded that real people are risking something, that's always so incredibly seductive to me.
I went north when trouble came, thought it stayed behind. Working my way through Michigan, finally crossed the line. I made my peace with solitude as years pushed on and by. Held your face as grace itself upon my life and time, upon my life and time. I know well what people say when I go to town. Though I keep my business straight, hold my tongue and my head down. Moving like the ghost that I've become within my mind. Where I've spent my days with you throughout my life and time. Throughout this life and time.
Do you guys have one more question in you? And then we'll do the lightning round.
The question is, do you?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. So this was another Mark Arely special. He gave me this idea. We were talking about you again, Joe. So your latest record, Life and Time, is a duo record with songwriter Mike Reed. So this was it's my understanding, because this is what I read on the internet, that this was your first recording and writing sessions together after you met at Rodney Crowell's songwriting camp. Does this sound true to you?
Yeah, okay. It does sound true.
So Mark and I were talking about how trust must have played a huge role in this project. So not only did you trust the lyrics to Mike's sense of melody and song structure, but also Mike's voice is delivering your lyrics. So when you met, other than like an appreciation for Mike's many hits, where did that sense of trust first originate from? And what was the spark that made you want to hand him the lyrics and go, you know, do something with it?
I'm laughing because the first thing that struck me is that he knew who I was. That went a long way to me. Like, we met and we just found ourselves in line together at the dining hall at Vanderbilt, where the songwriting camp was hosted, and which meant we got food together. We ended up sitting down together, and I of course knew who he was. I didn't think never occurred to me that he would have a notion who I was. But it started by him asking me about the poets that mattered to me. And within a few minutes, we were quoting a stanza across the table to each other from a poet that we realized we both love in common, who is a poet from Ohio named James Wright. And all the noise in this loud dining hall of all these arriving so-called campers, it just disappeared, and we were in this deep conversation within moments. And then the subsequent days, anytime there was a coffee break, I was looking for Mike. I was like, I'm gonna see if Mike wants to get a coffee. I need to keep talking to this person. There was just something completely, it was just a brotherhood that was completely, you know, there's that cliche, I met somebody and I feel like I've known them for decades. I felt that way about Mike. And Melanie will say, I remember that night you called me from the hotel in Nashville and telling me that you met this guy. It was a big enough deal to you in that moment that I could remember the telling of it. She said, I envisioned in that moment that you guys were going to work together in some way. I didn't imagine how deep it would go. I mean, I've written with a lot of people over years, but always really random, circumstantial, one-off kind of things. And my sister-in-law, I mean, I've probably written 4 songs with her. Otherwise, it was just like a one-off here and there. Michelle Ndegio-Cello, Ornette Coleman, you know, Roseanne Cash, a lot of people. Being in a relationship in a sustained, continuing way over what's now been, you know, 3 years, 3.5 years, something like that. I never had anything remotely like that happen to me. Songwriting had always been so deeply solitary, and I just was used to thinking that what I did was be confounding to people. And the idea of writing with somebody, like I got to try to explain to somebody why that's where I would next go, you know, with the next line or a next verse. I don't want to be thinking about it. I don't want to be explaining to anybody. As soon as I'm justifying why the next verse all of a sudden starts there from where we just were, we're not in the song anymore. I'm not in the creative stream anymore. I'm in the analytical mind. You know, John Cage made a big thing, really impressionable, made a big impression on me as a young person. You know, there's a big distinction between the creative mind and the analytical mind. And they both have a function, but they're not the same thing at all. And that first writing zone of just spooling off raw fabric, you know, it's really easy for me, for whatever reason, to come back after the fact and take that raw fabric and tailor it into a pair of slacks that I can wear around. But I want to stay in that unknowing. I want to stay in that swept away place for as long as possible before I'm ever thinking about what anything might mean or how it serves me or do I like it or will anybody else like it? Because then you're not in the stream anymore. You're up on the bank, you know, looking down at the water, talking about it, but you're not in it anymore. And I just want to stay in there as long as I possibly can. And that's largely true. What's the great Tom Waits quote? The way we do anything is the way we do everything. I live my life I trust my instincts, my internal knower. Every big decision I've ever made in my life was based, you know, the biggest ones, you know, who I married and what I do for a living, were not based on any reality that I could point to. They were both instinctive, immediate knowing in my person, in my body, that this is where my life was going to go. Not that it would be easy, but that's where it was going to get, where it was going to go. I've learned to trust my instinct that way. And Mike allowed me somehow to believe fully from the beginning that I could trust him and I could hand something over and not need to try to drive where it was going to go. Even stuff something that I wrote that I would really, really care deeply for, which with other people, I might be really reluctant to hand that one over because I can already hear where I want that one to go. And if they don't hear the same thing in it, I'm going to have a real hard time letting go of it. With Mike, I've never really felt that at all. And I've written some of my favorite things that I've ever written that I then handed off to Mike.
That's so beautiful. I mean, that
just makes me want to talk about past lives and like how you probably were like twin brothers like many, many times over.
He's more than a decade older than I am. He's 78. You know, even Melanie, she'll hear us, you know, on the phone and she said, you know, and I have a lot of really close friends. I've been really blessed to have a lot of great friendships in my life. And Melanie would say, you know, you've never in your life had another friendship like that one.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, what was I, 63 or something like that when I met him? 62?
You guys ready for the lightning round?
Sure.
Hell yeah.
Okay, we'll do both answer these questions I ask you.
Okay.
Mark's done the lightning round like thousands of
times.
Doesn't
mean I'm any better.
All right. Yeah. Here we go. What was the last movie you watched?
Oh,
the last movie I watched.
It was called Lights Out. It was really bad. Yeah, it's a horror movie.
Yeah, why would this be difficult? The last movie I watched was The New Frankenstein.
What are you reading right now before you go to bed?
Ann Patchett's collection of essays called This is the Story of a Happy Marriage.
I just finished a book by Richard Powers, who wrote, it's Richard Powers, yeah. He wrote The Overstory, which is one of my favorite books. And I've been delving into his back catalog. So I think the most recent one I read was Bewilderment. It was just fantastic.
This is a really important one. What pie are you ordering at the diner?
Oh, blackberry cobbler.
Oof, wow, okay.
Yeah, apple pie a la mode, I think. Classic.
This is two questions in one. What is your coffee order at the coffee shop, and how do you take your coffee at home?
You'd be right that those would be different things. I don't trust anybody else's espresso other than my own. So my order is an oat milk cortado. But when I'm at home, I'm pretty strictly a doppio kind of person.
Mine is actually the same everywhere. It's just a cup of drip coffee. And it's definitely, if I'm out and about, it's definitely ordered in person and not over the app. I want to talk to the person, and I want them to hand me the thing. I don't want to wait 20 minutes while the people that ordered on the app get their coffee before me. I just want to talk to the barista and get a cup of coffee. Yeah.
I'm glad this has come up, though, because I can make a drip coffee in the morning and will. I have many coffee systems in this house.
This is the last one. Hopefully one day we'll get a tour of all your coffee systems, because that sounds really fun, actually. Yeah. So this is the last one. Who would you like, besides Francie, who would you like to go to dinner with?
Who would I like to go to dinner with?
I know. This is going to sound maybe canned, but our oldest son is in college now, and he's just making such leaps and bounds, learning about himself, learning about the world. I just feel like he's like a new kid every day, or more of an adult every day. So and it's been a few weeks now, so I think I'd like to see him and be like, what's new? We're probably gonna have dinner tonight, so you should use someone else.
Well, you did come a spring to mind. Well,
who would you rather have dinner with, Joe? Randy Newman or Thomas Merton?
Oh, well, Randy Newman, if I'm completely honest.
I would pick Randy, too.
Yeah. I mean, would I love to... Joan Baez tells a fantastic story about Thomas Merton getting really drunk and wanting to follow her on the road when she went to meet him at Gethsemane in Lexington, Kentucky. And, she said, like, he was really... Like, she and her girlfriend went to see him and took him out into Lexington, I think, in that afternoon. And like, first thing he did was like eat like two cheeseburgers and have a beer. And he was really, they went to a quarry to swim, and they were drinking out of a flask. And he was like, decided that he was going to wanted to leave the monastery the next day and travel with Joan and her friend. And she said, we just slipped out the next morning because we just couldn't, I couldn't handle the pressure of like I would have led Thomas Merton off his path, Anyway.
I guess I also want to eat dinner with Joan Baez, apparently.
Yeah, you do. If I'm honest, I'd have a lot more sort of significant questions for Randy than I probably would for Thomas.
Wasn't there like a story about how Randy Newman has to sit with his back facing the restaurant because his kid is like too embarrassed? Did you tell me that story? No. Okay. I'm pretty sure you did. You could take credit for
this
it.
This kid's embarrassed because people come up to him all the time.
People come up to him all the time. And
yeah. Well, I met him only on one occasion, and I'm glad I got away with being introduced to him without having to like walk up to him.
Yeah. Joe Henry Marcarelli, this has been so fun, and I'm so grateful. Thank you so much.
Oh, a pleasure. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, we've been talking about a visit for a long time, so this seemed like, you know, many, many birds, one stone kind of situation. So thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks. If I go over there and Pro Tools is still running, it's going to be really...
Yeah.
Yeah, right. Oh, shit, we have to do it again.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Dietrich Strauss composes our music. Andrea Weber is our street team leader. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation, or BGS. You can find all of our episodes there. You can check us out on the SiriusXM by searching for Basic Folk. You can go and find us on FolkAlley.com or Folk Alley's mobile app. You can also listen to us at BasicFolk.com. Or you can listen wherever you get your shows. If you enjoyed this podcast, we suggest sharing it with a friend. Like if you have a friend who moved around a lot and then lived in Los Angeles for a really long time and is considering leaving Los Angeles to come to the coast of Maine, send it to that friend because I feel like they would get a lot out of this. Okay, thanks for listening all the way to the end. Talk to you next time. Bye.